phrases like ethnic folkways and nuts and flowers floated across the hushed circle. Then, fingers like a bunch of cheese straws clamped over the wizard's mouth and an extremely sharp cutting edge pinked his Adam's apple, and a damp voice right by his ear said, "Not a sound, or you is a dead man." Rincewind's eyes swiveled in their sockets as if trying to find a way out.
"If you don't want me to say anything, how will you know I understand what you just said?" he hissed.
"Shut up, and tell me what the other idiot is doing."
"No, but look, if I've got to shut up, how can I
The knife at his throat became a hot streak of pain, and Rincewind decided to give logic a miss.
"His name's Twoflower. He isn't from these parts."
"Doesn't look like it. Friend of yours?"
"We've got this sort of hate-hate relationship, yes."
Rincewind couldn't see his captor, but by the feel of it, he had a body made of coat hangers. He also smelt strongly of peppermints.
"He has got guts, so I'll give him that. Do exactly what I say, and it is just possible he won't end up with them wrapped around a stone." "They're not very ecumenical around here, you see."
It was at that moment that the moon, in due obedience to the laws of persuasion, rose. Although in deference to the laws of computing, it wasn't anywhere near where the stones said it should be. But what was there, peeking through the ragged clouds, was a glaring red star. It hung exactly over the circle's holiest stone, glittering away like the sparkle in the eye socket of death. It was sullen and awful, and Rincewind couldn't help noticing just a little bit bigger than it was last night. A cry of horror went up from the assembled priests. The crowd on the surrounding banks pressed forward. This looked quite promising. Rincewind felt a knife handle slip into his hand, and the squelchy voice behind him said,
"You ever done this sort of thing before?"
"What sort of thing?"
"Rushed into a temple, killed the priests, stolen the gold, and rescued the girl."
"No, not in so many words."
"You do it like this."
2 inches from Rincewind's left ear, a voice broke into a sound like a baboon with its foot trapped in an echo canyon, and a small but wiry shape rushed past him. By the light of the torches, he saw that it was a very old man, the skinny variety that generally gets called spry, with a totally bald head, a beard almost down to his knees, and a pair of matchstick legs on which varicose veins had traced the street map of quite a large city. Despite the snow, he wore nothing more than a studded leather holdall and a pair of boots that could have easily accommodated a second pair of feet. The two druids closest to him exchanged glasses and hefted their sickles. There was a brief blur, and they collapsed into tight balls of agony, making rattling noises. In the excitement that followed, Rincewind sidled along towards the altar stone, holding his knife gingerly so as not to attract any unwelcome comment. In fact, no one was paying a great deal of attention to him. The druids that hadn't fled the circle, generally the younger and more muscular ones, had congregated around the old man in order to discuss the whole subject of sacrilege as it pertained to stone circles. But judging by the cackling and the sounds of Gristle, he was carrying the debate. Twoflower was watching the fight with interest. Rincewind grabbed him by the shoulder. "Let's go," he said.
"Shouldn't we help?"
"I'm sure we'd only get in the way," said Rincewind hurriedly. "You know what it's like to have people looking over your shoulder when you're busy."
"At least we must rescue the young lady," said Twoflower firmly.
"All right, but get a move on."
Twoflower took the knife and hurried up to the altar stone. After several inept slashes, he managed to cut the ropes that bound the girl, who sat up and burst into tears.
"It's all right," he began.
"It bloody well isn't," she snapped, glaring at him through 2 red-rimmed eyes. "Why do people always go and spoil things?"
She blew her nose resentfully on the edge of her robe. Twoflower looked up at Rincewind in embarrassment.
I don't think you quite understand," he said. "I mean, we just saved you from an absolutely certain death."
"It's not easy round here," she said. "I mean, keeping yourself."
She blushed and twisted the hem of her robe wretchedly.
"I mean, staying. Not letting yourself be. Not losing your qualifications."
"Qualifications?"
said Twoflower, earning the Rincewind cup for the slowest person on the uptake in the entire multiverse. The girl's eyes narrowed.
I could have been up there with the moon goddess by now, drinking mead out of a silver bowl, she said petulantly. 8 years of staying home on Saturday nights right down the drain.
She looked up at Rincewind and scowled. Then he sensed something. Perhaps it was a barely heard footstep behind him, perhaps it was a movement reflected in her eyes, but he ducked. Something whistled through the air where his neck had been and glanced off Twoflower's bald head. Rincewind spun round to see the arch-druid readying his sickle for another swing, and in the absence of any hope of running away, lashed out desperately with a foot. It caught the druid squarely on the kneecap. As the man screamed and dropped his weapon, there was a nasty little fleshy sound, and he fell forward. Behind him, the little man with the long beard pulled his sword from the body, wiped it with a handful of snow, and said,
"My lumbago is giving me chip. You can carry the treasure."
"Treasure?" said Rincewind weakly.
"All the necklaces and stuff. All the gold collars. They've got lots of them. That's priests for you,"
said the old man wetly.
"Nothing but talk, talk, talk. Who's the girl?"
"She won't let us rescue her," said Rincewind. The girl looked at the old man defiantly through her smudged eyeshadow.
"Bugger that,"
he said, and with one movement picked her up, staggered a little, screamed at his arthritis, and fell over. After a moment he said from his prone position,
"Don't just stand there, you daft bitch. Help me up."
Much to Rincewind's amazement, and almost certainly to hers as well, she did so. Rincewind, meanwhile, was trying to rouse Twoflower. There was a graze across his temple which didn't look too deep, but the little man was unconscious, with a faintly worried smile plastered across his face. His breathing was shallow and strange. And he felt light, not simply underweight, but weightless. The wizard might as well have been holding a shadow. Rincewind remembered that it was said that druids used strange and terrible poisons. Of course, it was often said, usually by the same people, that crooks always had close-set eyes, lightning never struck twice in the same place, and if the gods had wanted men to fly, they'd have given them an airline ticket. But something about Twoflower's lightness frightened Rincewind, frightened him horribly. He looked up at the girl. She had the old man slung over one shoulder, and gave Rincewind an apologetic half-smile. From somewhere around the small of her back, a voice said,
"Got everything? Let's get out of here before they come back."
Rincewind tucked Twoflower under one arm and jogged along after them. They seemed the only thing to do. The old man had a large white horse tethered to a withered tree in a snow-filled gully some way from the circles. It was sleek, glossy, and the general effect of a superb battle charger was only very slightly spoiled by the hemorrhoid ring tied to the saddle.
"Okay, put me down. There's a bottle of some liniment stuff in the saddlebag, if you won't mind."
Rincewind propped Twoflower as nicely as possible against the tree, and by moonlight, and he realized by the faint red light of the menacing new star, took the first real look at his rescuer. The man had only one eye. The other was covered by a black patch. His thin body was a network of scars, and currently twanging white-hot with tendonitis. His teeth had obviously decided to quit long ago. "Who are you?"
"Bethan," said the girl, rubbing a handful of nasty-smelling green ointment into the old man's back.
She wore the air of one who, if asked to consider what sort of events might occur after being rescued from virgin sacrifice by a hero with a white charger, would probably not have mentioned liniment, but who, now liniment was apparently what did happen to you after all, was determined to be good at it.
"I meant him," said Rincewind.
One star-bright eye looked up at him.
"Cohenish, my name, boy."
Bethan's hands stopped moving.
"Cohen?" she said. "Cohen the Barbarian?"
"The very same."
"Hang on, hang on," said Rincewind.
"Cohen's a great big chap, neck like a bull, got chest muscles like a sack of footballs. I mean, he's the disc's greatest warrior, a legend in his own lifetime. I remember my granddad telling me he saw him. My granddad telling me he... My granddad..."
He faltered under the gimlet gaze.
"Oh," he said. "Oh, of course. Sorry."
"Yes," said Cohen and sighed. "That's right, boy. I'm a lifetime in my own legend.
Gosh, said Rincewind. How old are you exactly?
87.
But you were the greatest,
said Bethan.
Bards still sing songs about you.
Cohen shrugged and gave a little yelp of pain.
I never get any royalties, he said.
He looked moodily at the snow.
That's the saga of my life. 80 years in the business, and what have I got to show for it? Backache, piles, bad digestion, and 100 different recipes for soup. Soup? I hate soup.
Bethan's forehead wrinkled.
Soup?
Soup, explained Rincewind.
Yeah, soup,
said Cohen miserably.
It's me teeth, you see. No one takes you seriously when you got no teeth. They say, sit down by the fire, Grandad, and have some soup.
Cohen looked sharply at Rincewind.
That's a nasty cough you have there, boy.
Rincewind looked away, unable to look Bethan in the face. Then his heart sank. Twoflower was still leaning against the tree, peacefully unconscious, and looking as reproachful as was possible in the circumstances. Cohen appeared to remember him too. He got unsteadily to his feet and shuffled over to the tourist. He thumbed both eyes open, examined the greys, felt the pulse.
He's gone, he said.
Dead, said Rincewind. In the debating chamber of his mind, a dozen emotions got to their feet and started shouting. Relief was in full spate when shock cut in on a point of order, and then bewilderment, terror, and loss started a fight which was ended only when shame slunk in from next door to see what all the row was about.
No, said Cohen thoughtfully. Not exactly. Just gone.
Gone where?
I don't know, said Cohen, but I think I know someone who might have a map.
Far out on the snowfield, half a dozen pinpoints of red light glowed in the shadows.
He's not far away, said the leading wizard, peering into the small crystal sphere.
There was a general mutter from the ranks behind him, which roughly meant that however far away Rincewind was, he couldn't be further than a nice hot bath, a good meal, and a warm bed. Then the wizard, who was tramping along in the rear, stopped and said,
Listen!
They listened. There were the subtle sounds of winter beginning to close its grip on the land, the creak of rocks, the muted scuffling of small creatures in their tunnels under the blanket of snow. In a distant forest, a wolf howled, felt embarrassed when no one joined in, and stopped. There was the silver sleeting sound of moonlight. There was also the wheezing noise of half a dozen wizards trying to breathe quietly.
I can't hear a thing,
one began.
Shh! All right, all right.
Then they all heard it. A tiny, distant crunching, like something moving very quickly over the snow crust.
Wolves?
Said a wizard. They all thought about hundreds of lean, hungry bodies leaping through the night.
No, said the leader. It's too regular. Perhaps it's a messenger.
It was louder now, a crisp rhythm like someone eating celery very fast.
I'll send up a flare, said the leader.
He picked up a handful of snow, rolled it into a ball, threw it up into the air, and ignited it with a stream of octarine fire from his fingertips. There was a brief, fierce blue glare. There was silence. Then another wizard said,
You daft bugger. I can't see a thing now.
That was the last thing they heard before something fast, hard, and noisy cannoned into them out of the darkness and vanished into the night. When they dug one another out of the snow, all they could find was a tight, pressed trail of little footprints. Hundreds of little footprints, all very close together, and heading across the snow as straight as a searchlight.
A necromancer, said Rincewind.
The old woman across the fire shrugged and pulled a pack of greasy cards from some unseen pocket. Despite the deep frost outside, the atmosphere inside the yurt was like a blacksmith's armpit, and the wizard was already sweating heavily. Horse dung made a good fuel, but the horse people had a lot to learn about air conditioning, starting with what it meant. Bethan leaned sideways.
What's necromance?
She whispered.
Necromancy, talking to the dead,
he explained.
Oh, she said.
vaguely disappointed. They had dined on horse meat, horse cheese, horse black pudding, horse d'oeuvres, and a thin beer that Rincewind didn't want to speculate about. Cohen, who'd had horse soup, explained that the horse tribes of the Hubland Steppes were born in the saddle, which Rincewind considered was a gynecological impossibility, and they were particularly adept at natural magic, since life on the open steppe makes you realize how neatly the sky fits the land all around the edges, and this naturally inspires the mind to deep thoughts like, why? When? And why don't we try beef for a change? The chieftain's grandmother nodded at Rincewind and spread the cards in front of her. Rincewind, as it has already been noted, was the worst wizard on the disc. No other spells would stay in his mind once the spell had lodged in there, in much the same way that fish don't hang around in a pike pool. But he still had his pride, and wizards don't like to see women perform even simple magic. Unseen University had never admitted women, muttering something about problems with the plumbing. But the real reason was an unspoken dread that if women were allowed to mess around with magic, they would probably be embarrassingly good at it. "Anyway, I don't believe in Karok cards," he muttered. "All that stuff about it being the distilled wisdom of the universe is a load of rubbish." The first card, smoke-yellowed and age-crinkled, was... it should have been the star. But instead of the familiar round disc with crude little rays, it had become a tiny red dot. The old woman muttered and scratched at the card with a fingernail, then looked sharply at Rincewind. "Nothing to do with me," he said. She turned up the importance of washing the hands, the eight of octagrams, the dome of the sky, the pool of night, the four of elephants, the ace of turtles, and Rincewind had been expecting it. Death. And something was wrong with death, too. It should have been a fairly realistic drawing of death on his white horse, and indeed he was still there, but the sky was red-lit. And coming over a distant hill was a tiny figure, barely visible by the light of the horse-fat lamps. Rincewind didn't have to identify it, because behind it was a box on hundreds of little legs. The luggage would follow its owner anywhere. Rincewind looked across the tent to Twoflower, a pale shape on a pile of horsehides. "He's really dead," he said. Cohen translated for the old woman, who shook her head. She reached down to a small wooden chest beside her and rummaged around in a collection of bags and bottles until she found a tiny green bottle which she tipped into Rincewind's beer. He looked at it suspiciously.
"She says it's a sort of medicine," said Cohen. "I should drink it if I were you. These people get a bit upset if you don't accept hospitality."
"It's not going to blow my head off," said Rincewind.
"She says it's essential you drink it."
"Well, if you're sure it's okay, it can't make the beer taste any worse." He took a swig, aware of all eyes on him. "Oh," he said. "Actually, it's not at all bad." Something picked him up and threw him into the air, except that in another sense he was still sitting by the fire. He could see himself there, a dwindling figure in the circle of firelight that was rapidly getting smaller. The toy figures around it were looking intently at his body, except for the old woman. She was looking right up at him and grinning. The Circle C's senior wizards were not grinning at all. They were becoming aware that they were confronted with something entirely new and fearsome. A young man on the make. Actually, none of them were quite sure how old Trumon really was, but his sparse hair was still black, and his skin had a waxy look to it that could be taken in a poor light to be the bloom of youth. The six surviving heads of the eight orders sat at the long, shiny, and new table in what had been Galder Weatherwax's study, and each one wondered precisely what it was about Trumon that made them want to kick him. It wasn't that he was ambitious and cruel. Cruel men were stupid, they all knew how to use cruel men, and they certainly knew how to bend other men's ambitions. You didn't stay in eighth-level magus for long, unless you were adept at a kind of mental judo. It wasn't that he was bloodthirsty, power-hungry, or especially wicked. These things were not necessarily drawbacks in a wizard. The wizards were on the whole no more wicked than, say, the committee of the average Rotary Club, and each had risen to preeminence in his chosen profession not so much by skill at magic, but by never neglecting to capitalize on the weakness of opponents. It wasn't that he was particularly wise. Every wizard considered himself a fairly hot property, wise-wise. It went with the job. It wasn't even that he had charisma. They all knew charisma when they encountered it, and Trumon had all the charisma of a duck egg. That was it, in fact. He wasn't good or evil or cruel or extreme in any way but one, which was that he had elevated greyness to the status of a fine art and cultivated a mind that was as bleak and pitiless and logical as the slopes of hell. And what was so strange was that each of the wizards, who had in the course of their work encountered many a fire-spitting, bat-winged, tiger-taloned entity in the privacy of a magical octagram, had never before had quite the same uncomfortable feeling as they had when 10 minutes later Trumon strode into the room.
"Sorry I'm late, gentlemen," he lied, rubbing his hands briskly. "So many things to do, so much to organize. I'm sure you know how it is."
The wizards looked sidelong at one another as Trumon sat down at the head of the table and shuffled busily through some papers.
"What happened to old Galder's chair, the one with the lion arms and the chicken feet?" said Jiglad Wirt.
It had gone, along with most of the other familiar furniture, and in its place were a number of low leather chairs that appeared to be incredibly comfortable until you'd sat in them for 5 minutes.
"That, oh, I had it burnt,"
said Trumon, not looking up.
"Burnt? But it was a priceless magical artifact, a genuine—"
"Just a piece of junk, I'm afraid," said Trumon, treating him to a fleeting smile. "I'm sure real wizards don't really need that sort of thing. Now, if I may draw your attention to the business of the day—"
"What's this paper?" said Jiglad Wirt, of the Hoodwinkers,
waving the document that had been left in front of him, and waving it all the more forcefully because his own chair, back in its cluttered and comfortable tower, was of anything more ornate than Golder's had been.
"It's an agenda, Jiglad," said Trumon patiently.
"And what does agenda do?"
"It's just a list of the things we've got to discuss. It's very simple. I'm sorry if you feel that—"
"We've never needed one before."
"I think perhaps you have needed one. You just haven't used one," said Trumon, his voice resonant with reasonableness.
Wirt hesitated.
"Well, all right," he said sullenly,
looking around the table for support.
"But what's this here where it says—"
he peered closely at the writing—
"Successor to Greyhound Spold. It's going to be old Runelet Vard, isn't it? He's been waiting for years."
"Yes, but is he sound?" said Trumon.
"What?"
"I'm sure we all realize the importance of proper leadership," said Trumon. "Now, Vard, he's worthy, of course, in his way, but—"
"It's not our business," said one of the other wizards.
"No, but it could be," said Trumon.
There was silence.
"Interfere with the affairs of another order?" said Wirt. "Of course not," said Trumon. "I merely suggest that we could offer advice. But let us discuss this later."
The wizards had never heard of the words "power base." Otherwise, Trumon would never have been able to get away with all this. But the plain fact was that helping others to achieve power, even to strengthen your own hand, was quite alien to them. As far as they were concerned, every wizard stood alone. Never mind about hostile, paranormal entities, an ambitious wizard had quite enough to do fighting his enemies in his own order.
"I think we should now consider the matter of Rincewind," said Trumon.
"And the star," said Wirt. "People are noticing, you know."
"Yes, they say we should be doing something," said Lumwell Panter, of the Order of Midnight. "What, I should like to know?"
Oh, that's easy, said Wirt. They say we should read the octavo. That's what they always say. Crops bad, read the octavo. Cows ill, read the octavo. The spells will make everything all right.
There could be something in that, said Truman. My, late predecessor made quite a study of the octavo.
We all have, said Panter sharply, but what's the use? The eight spells have to work together. Oh, I agree, if all else fails, maybe we should risk it, but the eight have to be said together or not at all, and one of them is inside this Rincewind's head.
And we cannot find him, said Truman. That is the case, isn't it? I'm sure we've all tried. Privately.
The wizards looked at one another, embarrassed. Eventually, Wirt said,
Yes, all right, cards on the table. I can't seem to locate him.
I've tried scrying, said another. Nothing. I've sent familiars, said a third.
The others sat up. If confessing failure was the order of the day, then they were damn well going to make it clear that they had failed heroically.
Is that all? I've sent demons.
I've looked into the mirror of oversight.
Last night I sought him out in the ruins of Mahor.
I'd like to make it clear that I tried both the runes and the mirror and the entrails of a manicreech.
I've spoken to the beasts of the field and the birds of the air.
Any good?
No.
Well, I've questioned the very bones of the country, yea, and the deep stones and the mountains thereof.
There was a sudden chilly silence. Everyone looked at the wizard who had spoken. It was Ganmak Treehallet, of the Venerable Seers, who shifted uneasily in his seat.
Yes, with bells on, I expect, said someone.
I never said they answered, did I?
Truman looked along the table.
I've sent someone to find him, he said.
Wirt snorted. That didn't work out so well the last two times, did it?
That was because we relied on magic. But it is obvious that Rincewind is somehow hidden from magic. But he can't hide his footprints.
You've set a tracker?
In a manner of speaking.
A hero?
Wirt managed to pack a lot of meaning into the one word. In such a tone of voice, in another universe, would a southerner say, Damn Yankee? The wizards looked at Truman open-mouthed.
Yes,
he said calmly.
On whose authority?
Demanded Wirt. Truman turned his grey eyes on him.
Mine. I needed no other.
It's highly irregular. Since when have wizards needed to hire heroes to do their work for him?
Ever since wizards found their magic wouldn't work, said Truman.
A temporary setback, nothing more.
Truman shrugged.
Maybe, he said, but we haven't the time to find out.
Prove me wrong. Find Rincewind by scrying or talking to birds. But as for me, I know I'm meant to be wise, and wise men do what the times demand.
It is a well-known fact that warriors and wizards do not get along, because one side considers the other side to be a collection of bloodthirsty idiots who can't walk and think at the same time, while the other side is naturally suspicious of a body of men who mumble a lot and wear long dresses.
Oh, say the wizards, if we're going to be like that, then, what about all those studded collars and oiled muscles down at the Young Men's Pagan Association?
To which the heroes reply, That's a pretty good allegation coming from a bunch of wimpsos who won't go near a woman on account, can you believe it, of their mystical power being sort of drained out.
Right, say the wizards, that just about does it. You and your leather posing pouches...
Oh, yeah, say the heroes, why don't you...
And so on. This sort of thing has been going on for centuries, and caused a number of major battles, which have left large tracts of land uninhabitable because of magic harmonics. In fact,
The hero, even at this moment galloping towards the vortex planes, didn't get involved in this kind of argument because they didn't take it seriously, but mainly because this particular hero was a heroine, a red-headed one. Now, there is a tendency at a point like this to look over one's shoulder at the cover artist and start going on at length about leather, thigh boots and naked blades. Words like full, round and even pert creep into the narrative until the writer has to go and have a cold shower and a lie down, which is all rather silly, because any woman setting out to make a living by the sword isn't about to go around looking like something off the cover of the more advanced kind of lingerie catalogue for the specialised buyer. Oh well, all right. The point that must be made is that although Herenna the henna-haired harridan would look quite stunning after a good bath, a heavy-duty manicure, and the pick of the leather axe in Wu Hun Ling's Oriental Exotica and Martial Aids on Heroes Street, she was currently quite sensibly dressed in light chainmail, soft boots, and a short sword. All right, maybe the boots were leather, but not black. Riding with her were a number of swarthy men that will certainly be killed before too long anyway, so a description is probably not essential. There was absolutely nothing pert about any of them. Look, they can wear leather if you like. Herenna wasn't too happy about them, but they were all that was available for hire in Morpork. Many of the citizens were moving out and heading for the hills out of fear of the new star. But Herenna was heading for the hills for a different reason. Just turnwise and rimwards of the plains were the bare Trollbone Mountains. Herenna, who had for many years availed herself of the uniquely equal opportunities available to any woman who could make a sword sing, was trusting to her instincts. This Rincewind, as Trumon had described him, was a rat, and rats like cover. Anyway, the mountains were a long way from Trumon, and for all that he was currently her employer. Herenna was very happy about that. There was something about his manner that made her fists itch. Rincewind knew he ought to be panicking, but that was difficult because although he wasn't aware of it, emotions like panic and terror and anger are all to do with stuff sloshing around in glands, and all Rincewind's glands were still in his body. It was difficult to be certain where his real body was, but when he looked down he could see a fine blue line trailing from what, for the sake of sanity, he would still call his ankle, into the blackness around him. And it seemed reasonable to assume that his body was on the other end. It was not a particularly good body, he'd be the first to admit, but one or two bits of it had sentimental value, and it dawned on him that if the little blue line snapped, he'd have to spend the rest of his life, his existence, hanging around Ouija boards, pretending to be people's dead aunties, and all the other things lost souls do to pass the time. The sheer horror of this so appalled him he hardly felt his feet touch the ground. Some ground, anyway. He decided that it almost certainly wasn't the ground, which, as far as he could remember, wasn't black, and didn't swirl in such a disconcerting way. He took a look around. Sheer, sharp mountains speared up around him into a frosty sky hung with cruel stars, stars which appeared on no celestial chart in the multiverse, but right there in amongst them was a malevolent red disk. Rincewind shivered and looked away. The land ahead of him sloped down sharply, and a dry wind whispered across the frost-cracked rocks. It really did whisper. As grey eddies caught at his robe and tugged at his hair, Rincewind thought he could hear voices, faint and far off, saying things like, "Are you sure those were mushrooms in the stew? I feel a bit..." And, "There's a lovely view if you lean over this..." And, "Don't fuss, it's only a scratch." And, "Watch where you're pointing that bow, you nearly..." and so on. He stumbled down the slope with his fingers in his ears until he saw a sight seen by very few living men. The ground dipped sharply until it became a vast funnel, fully a mile across, into which the whispering wind of the souls of the dead blew with a vast echoing susurration, as though the disk itself was breathing. But a narrow spur of rock arched out and over the hole, ending in an outcrop perhaps 100 feet across. There was a garden up there, with orchards and flower beds, and a quite small black cottage. A little path led up to it. Rincewind looked behind him. The shiny blue line was still there. So was the luggage. It squatted on the path, watching him. Rincewind had never got on with the luggage. It had always given him the impression that it thoroughly disapproved of him. But just for once it wasn't glaring at him. It had a rather pathetic look, like a dog that's just come home after a pleasant roll in the cowpats, to find that the family has moved to the next continent.
"All right," said Rincewind. "Come on."
It extended its legs and followed him up the path. Somehow, Rincewind had expected the garden on the outcrop to be full of dead flowers, but it was in fact well kept, and had obviously been planted by someone with an eye for colour, always provided the colour was deep purple, night black, or shroud white. Huge lilies perfumed the air. There was a sundial with a gnome on in the middle of a freshly scythed lawn. With the luggage trailing behind him, Rincewind crept along a path of marble chippings until he was at the rear of the cottage, and pushed open a door. Four horses looked at him over the top of their nosebags. They were warm and alive, and some of the best-kept beasts Rincewind had ever seen. A big white one had a stall all to itself, and a silver and black harness hung over the door. The other three were tethered in front of a hay-rack on the opposite wall, as if visitors had just dropped by. They regarded Rincewind with vague animal curiosity. The luggage bumped into his ankle. He spun around and hissed, "Push off, you!" The luggage backed away. It looked abashed. Rincewind tiptoed to the far door and cautiously pushed it open. It gave onto a stone-flagged passageway, which in turn opened onto a wide entrance hall. He crept forward with his back pressed tightly against a wall. Behind him the luggage rose up on tiptoes and skittered along nervously. The hall itself, well, it wasn't the fact that it was considerably bigger than the whole cottage had appeared from the outside that worried Rincewind. The way things were these days, he'd have laughed sarcastically if anyone had said you couldn't get a quart into a pint pot. And it wasn't the decor, which was early crypt and ran heavily to black drapes. It was the clock. It was very big, and occupied a space between two curving wooden staircases covered with carvings of things that normal men only see after a heavy session on something illegal. It had a very long pendulum, and the pendulum swung with a slow tick-tock that set his teeth on edge, because it was the kind of deliberate, annoying ticking that wanted to make it abundantly clear that every tick and every tock was stripping another second off your life. It was the kind of sound that suggested very pointedly that in some hypothetical hourglass, somewhere, another few grains of sand had dropped out from under you. Needless to say, the weight on the pendulum was knife-edged and razor-sharp. Something tapped him in the small of the back. He turned angrily. "Look, you son of a suitcase, I told you—" It wasn't the luggage. It was a young woman, silver-haired, silver-eyed, rather taken aback. "Oh," said Rincewind. "Hello."
"Are you alive?" she said.
It was the kind of voice associated with beach umbrellas, suntan oil, and long, cool drinks.
"Well, I hope so," said Rincewind, wondering if his glands were having a good time wherever they were. "Sometimes I'm not so sure. What is this place?"
"This is the House of Death," she said.
"Ah," said Rincewind. He ran a tongue over his dry lips. "Well, nice to meet you. I think I ought to be getting along." She clapped her hands.
"Oh, you mustn't go," she said. "We don't often have living people here. Dead people are so boring, don't you think?"
Yes, Rincewind agreed fervently, eyeing the doorway. "Not much conversation, I imagine."
"It's always, when I was alive, and we really knew how to breathe in my day," she said, laying a small white hand on his arm and smiling at him. "They're always so set in their ways, too. No fun at all, so formal."
"Stiff?" suggested Rincewind.
She was propelling him towards an archway.
"Absolutely. What's your name? My name is Isabel."
Rincewind. "Excuse me, but if this is the House of Death, what are you doing here? You don't look dead to me."
"Oh, I live here."
She looked intently at him.
"I say, you haven't come to rescue your lost love, have you? That always annoys Daddy. He says it's a good job he never sleeps, because if he did, he'd be kept awake by the tramp, tramp, tramp of young heroes coming down here to carry back a lot of silly girls, he says."
"Goes on a lot, does it?" said Rincewind weakly.
as they walked along a black-hung corridor.
"All the time. I think it's very romantic. Only when you leave, it's very important not to look back."
"Why not?" She shrugged.
"I don't know. Perhaps the view isn't very good. Are you a hero, actually?"
No. Not as such. Well, not at all, really. Even less than that. In fact, I just came to look for a friend of mine," he said wretchedly. "I suppose you haven't seen him. Little fat man. Talks a lot. Wears eyeglasses. Funny sort of clothes."
As he spoke, he was aware that he may have missed something vital. He shut his eyes and tried to recall the last few minutes of conversation.
Then it hit him like a sandbag.
"Daddy?" She looked down demurely. "Adopted, actually," she said. "He found me when I was a little girl, he says. It was all rather sad."
She brightened.
"But come and meet him. He's got his friends in tonight. I'm sure he'll be interested to see you. He doesn't meet many people socially. Nor do I, actually," she added.
"Sorry," said Rincewind. "Have I got it right? We're talking about, death, yes? Tall, thin, empty eye sockets, handy in the scythe department?" She sighed.
"Yes. His looks are against him, I'm afraid."
While it was true that, as has already been indicated, Rincewind was to magic what a bicycle is to a bumblebee, he nevertheless retained one privilege available to practitioners of the art, which was that at the point of death, it would be Death himself who turned up to claim him, instead of delegating the job to a lesser mythological anthropomorphic personification, as is usually the case. Owing largely to inefficiency, Rincewind had consistently failed to die at the right time, and if there is one thing that death does not like, it is unpunctuality.
"Look, I expect my friend has just wandered off somewhere," he said. "He's always doing that. Story of his life. Nice to have met you. Must be going."
But she'd already stopped in front of a tall door padded with purple velvet. There were voices on the other side. Eldritch voices, the sort of voices that mere typography will remain totally unable to convey until someone can make a linotype machine with echo reverb and possibly a typeface that looks like something said by a slug. This is what the voices were saying.
"Would you mind explaining that again?"
"Well, if you return anything except a trump, South will be able to get his two roughs, losing only one turtle, one elephant, and one major arcana. Then..."
"That's two flower," hissed Rincewind. "I'd know that voice anywhere."
"Just a minute. Pestilence is South?"
"Oh, come on, Mort. He explained that. What if famine had played a trump return?"
It was a breathy, wet voice, practically contagious all by itself.
"Ah, then you'd only be able to rough one turtle instead of two," said Two Flower, enthusiastically. "But if war had chosen a trump lead originally, then the contract would have gone two down." "Exactly."
"I didn't quite follow that. Tell me about psychic bids again. I thought I was getting the hang of that."
It was a heavy, hollow voice, like two large lumps of lead smashing together.
"That's when you make a bid primarily to deceive your opponents, but of course it might cause problems for your partner."
Two Flowers' voice rambled on in its enthusiastic way. Rincewind looked blankly at Usabel as words like rebiddable suit, double finesse, and grand slam floated through the velvet.
"Do you understand any of that?" she asked.
"Not a word," he said.
"It sounds awfully complicated."
On the other side of the door, the heavy voice said,
"Did you say humans play this for fun?"
"Some of them get to be very good at it, yes. I'm only an amateur, I'm afraid."
"But they only live 80 or 90 years.
"You should know, Mort,"
said a voice that Rincewind hadn't heard before, and certainly never wanted to hear again, especially after dark.
"It's certainly very intriguing."
"Deal again, and let's see if I've got the hang of it."
"Do you think perhaps we should go in?"
said Usabel,
A voice behind the door said,
I bid the Knave of Terrapins.
No, sorry, I'm sure you're wrong. Let's have a look at your hand. Usabel pushed the door open. It was, in fact, a rather pleasant study, perhaps a little on the somber side, possibly created on a bad day by an interior designer who had a headache and a craving for putting large hourglasses on every flat surface, and also a lot of large, fat, yellow, and extremely runny candles he wanted to get rid of. The Death of the Disc was a traditionalist who prided himself on his personal service and spent most of the time being depressed because this was not appreciated. He would point out that no one feared death itself, just pain and separation and oblivion, and that it was quite unreasonable to take against someone just because he had empty eye sockets and a quiet pride in his work. He still used a scythe, he'd point out, while the deaths of other worlds had long ago invested in combine harvesters. Death sat at one side of a black baize table in the centre of the room, arguing with famine, war, and pestilence. Twoflower was the only one to look up and notice Rincewind.
"Hey, how did you get here?"
he said.
"Well, some say the Creator took a handful of... Oh, I see. Well, it's hard to explain, but I...
Have you got the luggage?"
The wooden box pushed past Rincewind and settled down in front of its owner, who opened its lid and rummaged around inside until he came up with a small leather-bound book, which he handed to War, who was hammering the table with a mailed fist.
"It's Nose Hinger on the Laws of Contract," he said. "It's quite good. There's a lot in it about double finessing and how to—"
Death snatched the book with a bony hand and flipped through the pages, quite oblivious to the presence of the two men.
"Right. Pestilence, open another pack of cards. I'm going to get to the bottom of this if it kills me. Figuratively speaking, of course."
Rincewind grabbed Twoflower and pulled him out of the room. As they jogged down the corridor with the luggage galloping behind them, he said,
"What was all that about?"
"Well, they've got lots of time, and I thought they might enjoy it," panted Twoflower. "What, playing with cards?"
"It's a special kind of playing," said Twoflower. "It's called..."
He hesitated. Language wasn't his strong point.
"In your language, it's called a thing you put across a river, for example," he concluded.
"I think."
"Aqueduct?" hazarded Rincewind.
"Fishing line?
Weir? Dam?"
"Yes, possibly."
They reached the hallway where the big clock still shaved the seconds off the lives of the world.
"And how long do you think that'll keep them occupied?"
Twoflower paused.
"I'm not sure," he said thoughtfully. "Probably until the last trump."
"What an amazing clock!"
"Don't try to buy it," Rincewind advised. "I don't think they'd appreciate it around here."
"Where is here, exactly?" said Twoflower, beckoning the luggage and opening its lid.
Rincewind looked around. The hall was dark and deserted, its tall narrow windows walled with ice. He looked down. There was the faint blue line stretching away from his ankle. Now he could see that Twoflower had one too.
"We're sort of informally dead," he said. It was the best he could manage.
"Oh,"
Twoflower continued to rummage.
"Doesn't that worry you?"
"Well, things tend to work out in the end, don't you think? Anyway, I'm a firm believer in reincarnation. What would you like to come back as?"
"I don't want to go," said Rincewind firmly. "Come on, let's get out of—"
"Oh, no, not that."
Twoflower had produced a box from the depths of the luggage. It was large and black and had a handle on one side and a little round window in front and a strap so that Twoflower could put it round his neck, which he did. There was a time when Rincewind had quite liked the iconoscope. He believed, against all experience, that the world was fundamentally understandable and that if he could only equip himself with the right mental toolbox, he could take the back off and see how it worked. He was, of course, dead wrong. The iconoscope didn't take pictures by letting light fall onto specially treated paper, as he had surmised, but by the far simpler method of imprisoning a small demon with a good eye for colour and a speedy hand with a paintbrush. He had been very upset to find that out.
"You haven't got time to take pictures," he hissed.
"It won't take long," said Twoflower firmly, and rapped on the side of the box.
A tiny door flew open, and the imp poked his head out.
"Bloody hell!"
it said.
Where are we?
It doesn't matter, said Twoflower. The clock first, I think.
The demon squinted.
Poor light, he said. 3 bloody years at F8, if you ask me.
He slammed the door shut. A second later, there was the tiny scraping noise of his stool being dragged up to his easel. Rincewind gritted his teeth.
You don't need to take pictures, you can just remember it, he shouted.
It's not the same, said Twoflower calmly.
It's better, it's more real.
It isn't really. In years to come, when I'm sitting by the fire...
You'll be sitting by the fire forever if we don't get out of here.
Oh, I do hope you're not going.
They both turned. Usabel was standing in the archway, smiling faintly. She held a scythe in one hand, a scythe with a blade of proverbial sharpness. Rincewind tried not to look down at his blue lifeline. A girl holding a scythe shouldn't smile in that unpleasant, knowing and slightly deranged way.
Daddy seems a little preoccupied at the moment, but I'm sure he wouldn't dream of letting you go off just like that, she added. Besides, I'd have no one to talk to.
Who's this? Said Twoflower. She sort of lives here, mumbled Rincewind. She's a sort of girl, he added.
He grabbed Twoflower's shoulder and tried to shuffle imperceptibly towards the door into the dark, cold garden. It didn't work, largely because Twoflower wasn't the sort of person who went in for nuances of expression, and somehow never assumed that anything bad might apply to him.
"Charmed, I'm sure," he said. "Very nice place you have here. Interesting Baroque effect with the bones and skulls."
Isabel smiled. Rincewind thought, "If death ever does hand over the family business, she'll be better at it than he is. She's bonkers."
"Yes, but we must be going," he said.
"I really won't hear of it," she said. "You must stay and tell me all about yourselves. There's plenty of time, and it's so boring here."
She darted sideways and swung the scythe at the shining threads. It screamed through the air like a neutered tomcat and stopped sharply. There was the creak of wood. The luggage had snapped its lid shut on the blade. Twoflower looked up at Rincewind in astonishment, and the wizard, with great deliberation and a certain amount of satisfaction, hit him smartly on the chin. As the little man fell backwards, Rincewind caught him, threw him over a shoulder, and ran. Branches whipped at him in the starlit garden, and small, furry, and probably horrible things scampered away as he pounded desperately along the faint lifeline that shone eerily on the freezing grass. From the building behind him came a shrill scream of disappointment and rage. He cannoned off a tree and sped on. Somewhere there was a path, he remembered. But in this maze of silver light and shadows, tinted now with red, as the terrible new star made its presence felt even in the netherworld, nothing looked right. Anyway, the lifeline appeared to be going in quite the wrong direction. There was the sound of feet behind him. Rincewind wheezed with effort. It sounded like the luggage, and at the moment he didn't want to meet the luggage because it might have got the wrong idea about him hitting its master, and generally the luggage bit people it didn't like. Rincewind had never had the nerve to ask where it was they actually went when the heavy lid slammed shut on them, but they certainly weren't there when it opened again. In fact, he needn't have worried. The luggage overtook him easily, its little legs a blur of movement. It seemed to Rincewind to be concentrating very heavily on running, as if it had some inkling of what was coming up behind it and didn't like the idea at all. "Don't look back," he remembered. "The view probably isn't very nice." The luggage crashed through a bush and vanished. A moment later, Rincewind saw why. It had careened over the edge of the outcrop and was dropping towards the great hole underneath, which he could now see was faintly red-lit at the bottom. Stretching from Rincewind, out over the edge of the rocks and down into the hole, were 2 shimmering blue lines. He paused uncertainly, although that isn't precisely true because he was totally certain of several things. For example, that he didn't want to jump, and that he certainly didn't want to face whatever it was coming up behind him, and that in the spirit world, Twoflower was quite heavy, and that there were worse things than being dead. "Name 2," he muttered, and jumped. A few seconds later, the horsemen arrived and didn't stop when they reached the edge of the rock, but simply rode into the air and reined their horses over nothingness. Death looked down.
"That always annoys me." I might as well install a revolving door.
I wonder what they wanted, said Pestilence.
Search me, said War. Nice game, though.
Right, agreed Famine. Compelling, I thought.
We've got time for another fondle.
Rubber, corrected War.
Rubber what?
You call them rubbers, said War.
Right, rubbers.
He looked up at the new star, puzzled as to what it might mean.
I think we've got time,
he repeated, a trifle uncertainly. Mention has already been made of an attempt to inject a little honesty into reporting on the disc, and how poets and bards were banned on pain of, well, pain, from going on about babbling brooks and rosy-fingered dawn, and could only say, for example, that a face had launched 1,000 ships if they were able to produce certified dockyard accounts. And therefore, out of a passing respect for this tradition, it will not be said of Rincewind and Twoflower that they became an ice-blue sine wave arcing through the dark dimensions, or that there was a sound like the twanging of a monstrous tusk, or that their lives passed in front of their eyes. Rincewind had in any case seen his past life flash in front of his eyes so many times that he could sleep through the boring bits, or that the universe dropped on them like a large jelly. It will be said, because experiment has proved it to be true, that there was a noise like a wooden ruler being struck heavily with a C-sharp tuning fork, possibly B-flat, and a sudden sensation of absolute stillness. This was because they were absolutely still, and it was absolutely dark. It occurred to Rincewind that something had gone wrong. Then he saw the faint blue tracery in front of him. He was inside the octavo again. He wondered what would happen if anyone opened the book. Would he and Twoflower appear, like a colour plate? Probably not, he decided. The octavo they were in was something a bit different from the mere book chained to its lectern deep in Unseen University, which was merely a three-dimensional representation of a multidimensional reality, and... Hold on, he thought. I don't like this. Who's thinking for me?
Rincewind,
said a voice like the rustle of old pages.
Who, me?
Of course you daft sod.
A flicker of defiance flared very briefly in Rincewind's battered heart.
Have you managed to recall how the universe started yet? He said nastily. The clearing of the throat, wasn't it? Or the drawing of the breath? Or the scratching of the head and trying to remember it? It was on the tip of the tongue?
Another voice, dry as tinder, hissed.
You would do well to remember where you are.
It should be impossible to hiss a sentence with no sibilance in it, but the voice made a very good attempt.
Remember where I am? Remember where I am? Shouted Rincewind. Of course I remember where I am. I'm inside a bloody book talking to a load of voices I can't see. Why do you think I'm screaming?
I expect you're wondering why we brought you here again,
said a voice by his ear.
No.
No?
What did he say?
Said another disembodied voice.
He said no. He really said no?
Yes.
Oh. Why?
This sort of thing happens to me all the time, said Rincewind. One minute I'm falling off the world, then I'm inside a book, then I'm on a flying rock, then I'm watching Death learn how to play Weir or Damn or whatever it was, and why should I wonder about anything?
Well, we imagine you will be wondering why we don't want anyone to say us,
said the first voice, aware that it was losing the initiative. Rincewind hesitated. The thought had crossed his mind, only very fast and looking nervously from side to side in case it got knocked over.
Why should anyone want to say you?
It's the star, said the spell. The red star. Wizards are already looking for you. When they find you, they want to say all 8 spells together to change the future. They think the disk is going to collide with the star.
Rincewind thought about this. Is it?
Not exactly, but what's that?
Rincewind looked down. The luggage padded out of the darkness. There was a long sliver of scythe blade in its lid. Oh, it's just the luggage, he said.
But we didn't summon it here.
No one summons it anywhere, said Rincewind. It just turns up. Don't worry about it.
Oh. What were we talking about?
This red star thing.
Oh, right. It's very important that you... Hello? Hello? Anyone out there?
It was a small and squeaky voice, and came from the picture box, still slung around Two Flowers' inert neck. The picture imp opened his hatch and squinted up at Rincewind.
Where's this, Squire?
It said. I'm not sure.
We still dead?
Maybe.
Well, let's hope we go somewhere where we don't need too much black, because I've run out.
The hatch slammed shut. Rincewind had a fleeting vision of Two Flower handing around his pictures and saying things like, This is me being tormented by a million demons, and this is me with that funny couple we met on the freezing slopes of the underworld. Rincewind wasn't certain about what happened to you after you really died. The authorities were a little unclear on the subject. A swarthy sailor from the Rimwood lands had said that he was confident of going to paradise, where there was sherbet and hoodris. Rincewind wasn't certain what a hoori was, but after some thought he came to the conclusion that it was a little licorice tube for sucking up the sherbet. Anyway, sherbet made him sneeze.
Now that the interruption is over,
said a dry voice firmly,
perhaps we can get on. It is most important that you don't let the wizards take the spell from you. Terrible things will happen if all 8 spells are said too soon.
I just want to be left in peace, said Rincewind.
Good, good. We knew we could trust you from the day you first opened the octavo.
Rincewind hesitated. Hang on a minute, he said. You want me to run around keeping the wizards from getting all the spells together?
Exactly.
That's why one of you got into my head?
Precisely.
You totally ruined my life, you know that, said Rincewind hotly. I could have really made it as a wizard if you hadn't decided to use me as a sort of portable spell book. I can't remember any other spells. They're too frightened to stay in the same head as you.
We're sorry.
I just want to go home. I want to go back to where... A trace of moisture appeared in Rincewind's eye. To where there's cobbles under your feet, and some of the beer isn't too bad, and you can get quite a good piece of fried fish of an evening, with maybe a couple of big green gherkins, and even an eel pie and a dish of whelks. And there's always a warm stable somewhere to sleep in. And in the morning you're always in the same place as you were the night before. And there wasn't all this weather all over the place. I mean, I don't mind about the magic. I'm probably not, you know, the right sort of material for a wizard. But I just want to go home.
But you must.
One of the spells began, but it was too late. Homesickness, the little elastic band in the subconscious that can wind up a salmon and propel it 3,000 miles through strange seas, or send a million lemmings running joyfully back to an ancestral homeland which, owing to a slight kink in the continental drift, isn't there anymore. Homesickness rose up inside Rincewind like a late-night prawn biryani, flowed along the tenuous thread linking his tortured soul to his body, dug its heels in, and tugged. The spells were alone inside their octavo. Alone, at any rate, apart from the luggage. They looked at it, not with eyes, but with consciousness as old as the Discworld itself.
And you can bugger off too,
they said. Dad. Rincewind knew it was himself speaking. He recognized the voice. For a moment he was looking out through his eyes, not in any normal way, but as a spy might peer through the cut-out eyes of a picture. Then he was back.
"You okay, Rincewind?"
said Cohen.
"You looked a bit gone there." "You did look a bit white," agreed Bethan, "like someone had walked over your grave."
Yes, it was probably me," he said. He held up his fingers and counted them. There appeared to be the normal amount. "Have I moved at all?" he said.
"You just looked at the fires as if you'd seen a ghost," said Bethan.
There was a groan behind them. Twoflower was sitting up holding his head in his hands. His eyes focused on them. His lips moved soundlessly.
"That was a really strange dream," he said. "What's this place?
Why am I here?" "Well," said Cohen, "some say the creator of the universe took a handful of clay and..." "No, I mean here," said Twoflower. "Is that you, Rincewind?"
"Yes," said Rincewind, giving it the benefit of the doubt.
"There was this... a clock that... And these people who..."
said Twoflower. He shook his head.
"Why does everything smell of horses?"
"You've been ill," said Rincewind. "Hallucinating."
"Yes, I suppose I was."
Twoflower looked down at his chest.
"But in that case, why have I..."
Rincewind jumped to his feet. "Sorry, very close in here. Got to have a breath of fresh air," he said. He removed the picture box's strap from Twoflower's neck and dashed for the tent flap.
"I didn't notice that when he came in," said Bethan.
Cohen shrugged. Rincewind managed to get a few yards from the yurt before the ratchet of the picture box began to click. Very slowly, the box extruded the last picture that the imp had taken. Rincewind snatched it. What it showed would have been quite horrible even in broad daylight. By freezing starlight, tinted red with the fires of the evil new star, it was a lot worse.
"No," said Rincewind softly. "No, it wasn't like that. There was a house, and this girl, and..."
"You see what you see, and I paint what I see,"
said the imp from its hatch.
"What I see is real. I was bred for it. I only see what's really there."
A dark shape crunched over the snow crust towards Rincewind. It was the luggage. Rincewind, who normally hated and distrusted it, suddenly felt it was the most refreshingly normal thing he had ever seen.
"I see you made it, then," said Rincewind.
The luggage rattled its lid.
"Okay, but what did you see?" said Rincewind. "Did you look behind?"
The luggage said nothing. For a moment they were silent, like two warriors who have fled the field of carnage and have paused for a return of breath and sanity. Then Rincewind said,
"Come on, there's a fire inside."
He reached out to pat the luggage's lid. It snapped irritably at him, nearly catching his fingers. Life was back to normal again. The next day dawned bright and clear and cold. The sky became a blue dome stuck on the white sheet of the world, and the whole effect would have been as fresh and clean as a toothpaste advert if it wasn't for the pink dot on the horizon.
"You can see it in daylight now," said Cohen. "What is it?"
He looked hard at Rincewind, who reddened.
"Why does everybody look at me?" he said. "I don't know what it is. Maybe it's a comet or something."
"Will we all be burned up?" said Bethan.
"How should I know? I've never been hit by a comet before."
They were riding in single file across the brilliant snowfield. The horse people, who seemed to hold Cohen in high regard, had given them their mounts and directions to the River Smarl, 100 miles rimward, where Cohen reckoned Rincewind and Twoflower could find a boat to take them to the Circle Sea. He had announced that he was coming with them on account of his chilblains. Bethan,